Hello, educators and learners, and welcome to Homeroom with Sal, brought to you by Khan Academy. We're an educational technology nonprofit dedicated to bringing a world-class education to anyone, anywhere, and Sal is our founder. I'm not Sal Khan, I'm David Reinstrom. I'm on the content team, and I'm here to introduce today's show. Since spring of 2020, Sal's been hosting a chat show on YouTube and Facebook Live called Homeroom with Sal, where he answers questions from our community and interviews notable folks from the worlds of education, technology, finance, entertainment, and more. We've taken some of our favorite conversations from that web show and turned them into a podcast. Without further ado, here is this week's podcast.
So with that, I am excited to introduce Alisa Villanueva Beard, CEO of Teach for America. Alisa, thanks for coming.
Hey, Sal. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here. And, congratulations on all the work that you all have been leading. It's been inspiring to see how you all have been meeting the moment. And so happy to be here and in this discussion.
And likewise. And maybe a good place to start, there's a ton of questions I want to ask, and I want to encourage everyone watching, they can go on the message boards on Facebook or YouTube, wherever they're watching this, and they can ask questions that hopefully we'll be able to surface to Alisa. But Alisa, just to get everyone on the same page, explain to everyone watching what the focus of Teach for America is. I think most people have heard of it. It's one of the nonprofits that I've always looked up to when I started Khan Academy. But you tell me in your own words, what is Teach for America?
Well, our focus is working alongside many partners to take on educational inequity at the highest level, right? So what we know for sure at Teach for America is that potential is distributed equally across all lines of difference, but the opportunity and the access to meet that potential does not exist with all kids in all communities in our country. And, you know, long before COVID, our system was not serving many kids well enough. And so I think that's really important for folks to understand. And just to ground folks in that, you know, when you look at our lowest income communities who are disproportionately children of color, about 50% of kids are graduating from high school. And that's compared to 96% of kids in the most affluent communities. And of those kids graduating from high school, about 6% make it to and through college. And Teach for America exists to say that is not okay and are committed to creating a different reality. And so we know that the problem is systemic and there needs to be change within and outside of education to really lead to a different reality. We know many interventions are needed in order to be able to take this on, and our contribution is leadership. So we go out and we recruit, support, and develop, you know, exceptional equity-oriented leaders who teach for at least 2 years in urban and rural America. They're expected to, you know, ensure that our kids get the education they deserve, and through that are able to get this clarity of conviction and understanding of the system, the possibility of it, the greatness of our children, and become lifelong advocates and change agents in education. We've been around for 30 years. We're now 65,000 strong, core members and alumni. And our folks, 8 in 10 of our folks in our alumni network work within education or have a career serving a low-income community, which is incredible because most folks that joined us had no intention of taking on this career path.
No, and you know, just to give people a perspective, you know, when you go to an education circles, people who are leading change, either directly or even now they work in industry, but on the philanthropic side or the policy side, you meet Teach for America alumni everywhere. So y'all have been definitely the alumni, the leadership is happening. And how does that happen? Is you're recruiting students coming primarily out of college and graduate schools with for any young people listening, either high school students or college students, how do they become part of this Teach for America core?
Yeah, our mandate is to go out and say, you know, get young people, 75% of our core are right out of college. And so we're just trying to get people to see this is amongst the greatest injustices of our time. There's no way for a country to thrive to be able to ensure that everyone can fully contribute without ensuring that every child has access to an excellent and equitable education. And to take that on, and this young generation really understands the nature of the systemic problem. You know, we find that folks have on their mind the need to take on climate change, income inequality, unemployment, you know, systemic racism. And there's many ways to take that on. And one thing that we try to say is like ground zero for all these inequities are honestly in the classroom, because you get to see how all the systems in a community collide and end up, you know, because our kids don't live in vacuums, and all of that ends up in a classroom. And you start to see how you have to, you know, of course, hold our kids to the highest expectations and also provide all the supports, all the unmet needs that kids come with to school. And then you're able to see like things can be different. Our kids can do anything. And we just have to be able to figure out how do these systems interact together? What can we do about them, and work in coalitions and powerful coalitions to get common things done for kids. And so we're out on college campuses looking for exceptional folks who demonstrate leadership, and are up for, you know, one of the greatest leadership, you know, challenges ever. I will say, even as CEO, my hardest job was right out of college, which was being a TFA core member in 1998 in Phoenix, Arizona, because it's like the best preparation to be a CEO, I will say.
I can only imagine. You know, what is fast forwarding to today, you know, especially we're in COVID, I am curious. We started to talk before we started going live, but how has COVID impacted Teach for America on all directions? You know, what's going on with your existing teacher corps who were in classroom, but now I'm guessing doing primarily distance learning? How is that affecting your pipeline of finding future leaders?
Yeah. So, you know, we're in the moment, as we all know, the greatest disruption in education in U.S. history, recent history, certainly. And, you know, for us, we right away, so I talked about, we have this network of, you know, 65,000 folks. We right away knew that, you know, we centered on how we were going to meet the moment. And so we're able to get our community, our network, you know, learning together. We created an educator resource hub to share best practices right away. We had a platform where our core members and alumni were able to, you know, put forth projects that they were trying to fund to just meet the basic needs for kids or things that were most pressing in our communities. And so we're able to do that. But for us, very practically, the first big pivot we had to make was our summer training. And so in March, when we realized that we weren't going to be able to run summer school programs, which is a main component of how we train our teachers, we had to figure out if we were even going to be able to bring in a core, because we were going to have to train them in a fundamentally different way. And so when we went out and asked our principals and superintendents, you know, do you want our teachers, even though they haven't, you know, taught kids, which is core to our model, you know, we got a resounding yes. Now more than ever, we need your teachers. And so we pulled together just our incredible staff, you know, from national teams, regional teams, to design. We had our Miami-Dade, you know, executive director run our program to design a new training curriculum in 9 weeks. We executed on that in, you know, 4 weeks and 2 days. And it was an incredible endeavor. What we saw was our teachers, you know, coming together in one network and feeling, you know, really the most prepared we've seen in terms of how we, what needs we were able to meet. We spent less money, and so we were able to pivot there. And we saw, you know, our core members just rising to the occasion, the highest retention we've had also throughout the summer. So folks just so committed, as we like process the world around us, knowing, gosh, there's no greater impact that I, you know, one can be making than in the classroom with students. And so it's been quite inspiring to sort of see the staff and the network come together to meet the moment.
Yeah, and there's something powerful about that. You know, you, like the entire education world, had to quickly go to virtual instruction, which was probably really good preparation. There's a lot of negatives about it, but really good preparation for the teachers having to then enter into a virtual environment right now. You know, I'm curious about you on the training side. What do y'all focus on in that training? And are there things that y'all do in that training that you wish were part of kind of the mainstream schools of ed? What would you do if you could wave a magic wand on what happens in all teacher training in the U.S. or in the world?
Well, there's a few things, Sal, that we've learned over time that just really matter. And so that one of the first things that's so relevant to this moment is the power of relationships. And I don't know how that rings to you as you hear that. But it's been really that is so critical in this very moment. You know, our stats are showing, or the stats that folks are sharing, is that we have about 3 million kids that haven't engaged in learning over, you know, since March. Either they don't have devices, that about 17 million do not have connectivity or devices, which is, you know, like something we just deeply need to take on. But we know that the only way to engage kids and families into learning is relationships. And so that's a big component of just like, what does it mean to, you know, to be able to build the trust? And I believe change only happens as fast as there is trust and deep relationships. And so that is a component of what we do. We, of course, also focus on, you know, rigorous content. We were able to ensure that all of our core members got some training on, you know, the science of reading. And we know that this is just so critical. I think every teacher at school needs to ensure that all teachers get access to this. We do, you know, training around computational thinking. As we think about 21st century, you know, preparedness, and the fact that 65% of kids in grade school today are gonna, you know, seek out jobs that we don't even know what they are today, is so critical. And so how are we developing those critical thinking skills and the social emotional skills that are needed? We also teach in a trauma-informed way. And so that's core to the training that we are able to provide to our teachers and the support. And especially in this moment when our kids are in the middle of experiencing severe loss, fear, and so much uncertainty, we've got to ensure that we're really able to meet the basic needs for kids, the human needs, and then be able to support them so that academically we're not leaving an entire generation behind, which is what so many people are talking about. And that's still a choice to be made. Then, of course, we have an entire focus on racial equity and ensuring that our teachers are culturally competent teachers and able to support our kids in a way that's most responsible, that leads to the most learning and engagement overall.
No, that makes a ton of sense. You know, we're having questions come in on social media from Facebook. Livy Valenzuela asks, do you believe children will be behind once we return to actual physical school? What can I do as a parent?
You know what? I mean, I know you're familiar, Sal, with all the studies coming out from NWEA, McKinsey, so many folks who are analyzing the situation. And the truth of the matter is that without question, kids are, on average, are going to be behind, and especially children growing up in low-income communities who are disproportionately kids of color who were already likely behind on average coming into schools. The fact that, as I said earlier, 17 million kids still don't have access to devices and connectivity. And that's only part of it. As I know you have said, Sal, that like technology for technology's sake is not the point. Once you even then have the technology, we then have to ensure that we are, you know, developing our teachers on how to then teach with this and ensure that that is in place so our kids are able to engage. And so I do believe that, you know, every indicator is telling us that our kids are going to be grossly behind. And so the things I think we've got to be focused on is number one, ensuring that everyone truly does have access to a device and connectivity, because this isn't about this pandemic. This is about the future. This is just a tool that every kid needs. It is the basics like paper and pencils. We talk about everyone needs a backpack, a paper and a pencil to start school. Everyone needs access to a device and connectivity moving forward for us to continue to find the path forward to best educate all kids. And we've got to train our teachers on that. Also, we've got to ensure that we have information about what our kids need. You know, there's a lot of questions right now about testing and should we be testing our kids or not? And it's often tied to accountability. And this is a moment to, you know, reimagine how we think about testing and accountability for this year. What I feel strongly about, as imperfect as tests are, we really need to know where are our kids so that we can appropriately intervene, so that we can be smart about our investments in ensuring that kids get what they need. And then the last thing I'll say is we need to make sure that we are advocating for dollars, for funding. During the last Great Recession, we invested a lot more than we have in this moment. Through this crisis right now, we have seen 5 times less funding coming into schools with a much greater challenge with many complexities. So not only do we need to meet the basic needs of kids, right? I'm watching educators in schools right out of, you know, after the pandemic, figure out how are we going to feed our kids? We're realizing schools feed kids. Schools provide all these social, you know, like social nets for kids that suddenly are gone, safety, access to a clinic, et cetera. And so right away, our educators have been focused on meeting those needs. And we're going to have to continue to do that and the trauma-informed teaching, but also, you know, the academics and be smart about that and be ensure that it's personalized and that we're really ensuring that parents and their families and kids are and teachers, educators are able to work together to figure out how to close those gaps. So as a parent, I would just be asking questions about how do we know where our kids are and where investments need to go? And do we have the investments needed to ensure that we're able to educate all kids and invest in our greatest natural resource we have in this country, which is our students?
Absolutely. And just to add, Livy, to Lisa's response, which I 100% agree with, you know, above and beyond everything that the schools are doing, when you ask what you can do as a parent, you know, my advice there is, I don't know how old your children are, but to Lisa's point, there's ways that you can evaluate where your kids are. You can go to Khan Academy, especially in math and science and yes. Expanding to other areas. But you can use what we call our Get Ready for Grade Level courses. They have something called a course challenge in it. And let's say you have a child who's, I'm making it up, entering sixth grade or just entered sixth grade a few months ago. You can do the Get Ready for Sixth Grade course challenge. If they score 80, 90% on it, that means they don't have any significant gaps from pre-sixth grade. And then I would recommend them working at their own time and pace, 20 to 40 minutes a day in math, in personalized practice, going through and trying to get mastery in all of sixth grade on Khan Academy. And if they are having trouble in the get ready for sixth grade, they can go and look at the units, or you can work with them to look at the units where they have trouble, and then they should get mastery in those gaps, and then they can go on to the sixth grade work. I feel confident if they do that 20, 30, 40 minutes a day over the course of the school year and beyond, they're going to do just fine. They might even accelerate their learning. On the English and language arts side, there's tools, Khan Academy you can use. There's 4Pay tools that are pretty good too, like Lexia, Raz Kids. Once again, you can do 20, 30 minutes a day, but it can often be as simple as, you know, asking them to read a magazine article, depending on their age, read it, and then we'll discuss it at lunch. If you create those kind of habits over the course of the year, and then, you know, the writing, just make sure they don't atrophy that skill. Say, hey, once a week, I want you to write something that you want to change at home, you know, change your bedtime, something you want to change in the world, we'll discuss it. That's gonna make sure they don't atrophy. But those are just some things you can make sure. And if your kids do fine just in your household, I have no doubt that they're not gonna fall behind. It's still gonna be suboptimal, but they won't fall behind.
Yes. Great advice.
There's a question here from Facebook, Laura Jones. Even students who are straight A honor students are failing. How do we help them recover from this, even with devices kids are struggling? And Alisa, I'll add to that question. What are y'all telling, you know, what are your teachers seeing, and what are you telling them for this? You know, there's a teacher who lives in my cul-de-sac who has, you know, and I live in a upper middle class neighborhood where she also is seeing 5-10% of her kids are completely disengaged right now. How are y'all coaching the teaching core to re-engage or keep these kids engaged and prevent the situation that Laura is talking about of a former straight A student now failing classes?
Yeah. This is such an important question, Sal, and there's a few things that come to mind. One is that we haven't hit on yet is I observe that a lot of the way we're trying to approach virtual teaching is the way we approached, you know, being in school, which really is not working for kids. I mean, there's just enough data and information that we have. And if we should just go talk to our kids, I mean, parents talk to their kids every day, and you often hear, it's boring. I don't understand the point of it. It just feels so irrelevant and not pressing. And so this is an opportunity. And, you know, we're at TFA, we talk about like the need for radical reimagination. This is a time for creativity. This is time to say that isn't working. What is relevant to our kids? Like this, the work kids should be doing should be in context of what's happening in the world right now. There's so much happening in the world right now that's helping to build their own, you know, their knowledge and skills. I read something on the 74 million, and they're doing these letters, student letters to adults saying, hello, here's what we need and want. And examples like get kids to, you know, in your economics class to actually go figure out how are you going to save the business that is going out of, you know, doesn't have the, because of COVID and the shutdown of the economy is deeply struggling. Like, what are the solutions to that? And what would you do? And, you know, what would you tell the mayor or the governor? And just like real world context that we can actually really grab onto and figure out how do we start ensuring that there's relevance, that one size fits all, you know, doesn't work anymore for to meet our kids where they are. And I don't think they're going to show up unless they can see that this matters and is interesting, and you know, and that they're actually getting something for it. The other thing that we observe going on, you know, as we talk to our own teachers, is our kids have a lot going on. You know, our kids now are supporting their own families. They've watched, you know, their families lose jobs, and so you know, I observe some systems saying, you know, you got to show up for these hours, and here's the expectation. But it's not in the context of a global pandemic and the impacts of what that is having on our kids, their families, and their lives. And so we've just got to be more in conversation and in relationship with, again, families and the students themselves to really understand their circumstances to then be able to figure out, you know, how do we adapt? I'm watching some of our school leaders get really present with that and say, we can't expect kids to be in school all day. They're not going to do it. They actually have to go work to support their family. And so instead, we're going to have these hours in the evening that seem to work better, 6 to 9, or, you know, when this is when we're going to actually host classes. And so just the need to really figure out how do we meet people where they are in this moment. And that's what I'm observing of our network as well. There's this one school in St. Louis led by TFA alums, Kairos Academy. And they had technology already. I mean, their whole method was it's year round school. They do least learning chunks in 7 weeks, and so they have the technology because they're big on personalized learning. But they know that's just one tool. Like the thing they also have is the relationships and the deep understanding of how important that is to be able to execute. And so they were able to, through this pandemic, they have pods. There's one adult to 10 kids who are in relationship, understanding the needs, and that person also is a liaison to the families. And so there's a constant, you know, adapting and ensuring that there's like, you know, real understanding in order to ensure that we're able to keep kids engaged, and their engagement rate is through the roof. And so it takes us really thinking about the work differently and understanding and being empathetic to what our kids' needs and really present to that.
No, I absolutely. And, you know, the only thing I would add to that is depending on the age of the student, if you're talking about someone pre-high school, you know, grades matter in that they're a signal and that you don't want to fail a whole yes. grade and have to repeat it. But the important thing is that the child keeps mastering the concepts. And as we mentioned, there's tools to do that to make sure they keep mastering. In high school, when the stakes are a little bit higher in terms of your transcript and college admissions, I would have a conversation. I mean, definitely talk to the child, talk to the student, but also talk to the school about it. Because I think right now you're seeing people are being, you know, they understand that this is a very weird situation and there should be yes. more outlets for kids who maybe are failing or having struggling to eventually be able to get back on the horse and show that they know the material. But yeah, it's a real issue. Let's see, one more, we have time, maybe one more question. This time goes by fast when we're having fun, Lisa. From YouTube Smart Bear, how do we help students re-enter school? I mean, like before they were happy to enter schools because they had friends and there was no virus, but now students will be filled with fear to enter school because of the pandemic. Well, I guess it could be, I think most people aren't thinking about seriously re-entering schools until at earliest the spring, maybe next school year. But I think even then the question is relevant. People might not be afraid of the virus then, but friendships might have been broken, all sorts of learning gaps. They're not even used to the pattern of waking up and getting ready and getting on the school bus. How do you think that's going to play out? What should we do?
Well, you know, Sal, this is where I go back to, like, my hope is that we don't just say everyone should go back to school and be doing school in the same way, right? Because there are a segment of kids who are thriving in this environment, who actually don't like the social and get intimidated and, you know, and are able to just sort of clear the air and really thrive in this environment. And my question is, why can't that continue to be true? And also figure out how we can be doing schools and getting kids back with each other. We do have enough research that shows that, you know, the social development part of this is really important, especially for the younger kids in being back at school. I mean, my kids have been, I have four sons and they've been back in school now for nearly 11 weeks. And they love going to school and they go to a Montessori school and they have really loved the opportunity to go back. It's smaller schools, it's smaller class sizes. And, you know, they're able to, you know, it's been interesting to watch my kids thrive in the environment that's a bit different than what it was before. But I think we just have to really be in communication with our kids and hopefully thinking creatively of how do we do school now that it got interrupted? Like, what did work about that for, you know, some kids? What didn't work about that? And how do we really listen to students and families and communities? You know, I think solutions are within the community, and we often don't spend enough time really understanding that to then inform our approach, which I just think is so key to being able to do this well.
Yeah. Well, no. Well, you know, there's so much we could continue to talk about. Alyssa, as I said, Teach for America is, I think, one of the not-for-profits that I always cite. You know, honestly, one of the reasons why I even thought Khan Academy could be a not-for-profit, I was like, well, look, here's a not-for-profit that is in education. They've been able to scale, able to have incredible impact. And so, you know, I've always looked up to the work that y'all do. And I think what we're doing is very complementary in terms of, you know, y'all are working on kind of the human capital that really is so key in reaching students and the leadership. And we're working on the tools and the content to help support both that those teachers and the kids they serve and the families. So it's been a pleasure to chat with you. And I hope we can keep this conversation going on future days, both on a live stream and not.
Yes, you got it. Thank you so much, Sal.
If you want to hear more conversations with Sal, subscribe to this podcast and tell a friend. If you want to support the work we do here at Khan Academy, visit khanacademy.org/donate. We're a nonprofit, and we appreciate your financial support in making sure that our materials can reach as many learners as possible, especially during this moment of COVID lockdowns. That's khanacademy.org/donate. That's our podcast, folks. Your host is Sal Khan. This show is produced by my wonderful Khan Academy co-workers, Kevin Dangor, Stephanie Yamkovenko, Dan Tu, Irene Wang, Jenna Herzog, Anthony Nelson, Felipe Escamilla, Irene Chen, Ken Jones, Fail Lundberg, and me, David Reinstrom. Our intro theme is Time Flux by Revolution Void. Our outro theme is Onward by Poddington Bear.